Pack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. It's time to stay. It's the return of the Top Chef Judges Table podcast here at Rob Has a Website, Reality Rehap Ups. I am Antonio Mazzaro, and we usually we have a roundtable of three others here on the Top Chef podcast. Unfortunately, Kurt Clark is not with us this week, but we do have his rap name to join us, but we're going to hear about that later. First, I want to introduce you to Mike Bloom and Josh Wiggler. Guys, how are you?
Sup? We're talking about Top Chef. We're not being bereft. Got a palate that's cleft. Yeah, don't act deaf.
I'm just trying to anticipate where you're going, Mike. I don't endorse that last one.
I thought you were being like a hype boy, like shouting out, cleft.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. I'm trying
that's
to
what
like,
hype boys do in the club, right? They just shout the last word of every line in a song.
Song!
this is not going to persist throughout the entire podcast, is it, guys?
Guys. No,
it's not.
It's one of those things like when you were a kid, you start playing that game where you repeat everything.
The repeater.
Yeah.
Are we going to get caught doing the repeater?
That will happen. Yes. So if you're not familiar with what we do here at the Top Chef Judges Table podcast at Reality Rehap Ups, we don't repeat each other every week. We try to build on each other's thoughts instead of repeat them. If you're not subscribed to our iTunes feed, you can do so. robhasawebsite.com/RHAPUPS. That will give you not only our Top Chef podcast, but also the RHAP Happy Hour with Jordan Parhar, MTV's Challenge podcast, and recaps of The Bachelor, including some little coverage of American Ninja Warrior, I think. So that's what we do here. You can also always tweet your thoughts about the show to us. I'm at AC Mazzaro. Kurt is at Kurt Clark. He's not here, unfortunately. Josh is at Round Howard. And Mike is at A Mike Bloom Type. We've got your thoughts on this week's show. Our first Philip Less show on Top Chef. Guys, were you sad that there's no Philip this week?
Always.
I mean, his presence was definitely missed, and we saw him a little bit in Last Chance Kitchen, but not too much. That being said, I still thought this was a very entertaining episode. I think these challenges sort of harken back to the beefsteak episode, where there were two really different types of challenges that made this chef step out of their comfort zone, and I enjoyed both aspects of it. And I think it just speaks to the strength of this cast overall, that even with arguably its biggest character missing, there were still some great moments to be had.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I loved the move up north. I loved getting to San Francisco. I'm glad that we're in that region of California right now. There was a lot of goofiness in this episode, even without Phil. So you're fine that he's not there, but then you think about it and you're like, oh my God, Philip could have met MC Hammer. He could have met MC Hammer and we could have seen it and it would have been so absurd. But that being said, for that to have happened, some other deserving chefs probably would have had to go. So I think that you kind of just have to take it as it is. But we can dream. We can dream.
Yeah, at some point you have to kind of pivot away from the comic relief and get back to the actual competition of the show. And remember that we've got a lot of really talented chefs still to cook, still to cook. And you're right, Josh. I mean, Phil, it's not that Philip wasn't a talented chef, but he kind of looms over this season a little bit. This episode, in fact, starts with sort of a weird little eulogy for Philip. I really thought it was hilarious. Kwame says, "I understood him." And then Marjorie deadpans, "I didn't."
I feel like we didn't get enough Marjorie and Philip interaction. I feel like we saw a lot of Philip interaction with Kwame, with Amar, with Jason, but Marjorie, I feel like, was one of the people that did not put up with any of Philip's BS, and they didn't cut to her enough when Philip was talking at any point in time during his tenure on Top Chef.
Yeah. We could have had a little more of that, I think.
Yeah, he was a bro. Philip was a bro through and through, and even though Marjorie can kind of mess around in the kitchen, and we've seen her kind of busting chops and joking around, she and Philip were just not on the same terms in terms of that. So yeah, she didn't really get him. That's fine. It's really funny that she said that. Got a big laugh on the show. They didn't raise a huge glass to Philip like they have for other competitors, but they also didn't really mock him. Carl said, like, look, I'm glad, he went out doing his food and he really stood by. Carl wasn't even saying, like, between the lines, like, his nonsense. He really stood by what he was doing throughout. So good for him. And we'll see that. We'll see Isaac saying, restaurant wars, you won't pick me last. So that's kind of the last sort of vestiges of last episode. And we do then, as you're saying, Josh, move away and go to, San Francisco, the Bay Area, Northern California. This is fantastic. We only have 7 chefs left. And right away, we're getting backstory about Amar and Marjorie. We find out Amar's father passed away, and that's really why he cooks. And we find out from Marjorie that her parents ran a soup kitchen and told her really to share yourself with people through food. Did either of those kind of interstitials or scenes there, guys, make you worried that one of these two is going home tonight?
Absolutely. I thought from this moment until Amar's dish got tasted at the Elimination Challenge, I thought this was his farewell episode. Because, you know, we talked in the early episodes of Top Chef how usually it's a 50-50 gamble that if there's the backstory and there's pictures being shown of various chefs' backstories, they're either going to win the episode or they're going to be eliminated. But we had seen so little of Amar beforehand. He'd ended up on the bottom, almost went home last week. And, throughout that, we'll talk about the Elimination Challenge later, but throughout that, he says, like, this has to be perfect. And it's tough to really cook that perfect food. And I feel like he had probably the biggest pressure on him going into that challenge. So I was completely underestimating him. I thought he was going to blow it and get eliminated. So I was pleasantly surprised that not only did he not go home, but he ended up winning his first challenge ever.
Yeah, it's interesting because you do get those stories, and like you would think that, like, oh, this is great from a girl, Marjorie. Like, yeah, we're getting some more backstory, and she's already on a roll, so we're just boosting that up. And then it's like, yeah, we're probably learning a lot about Amar right now, because it seems like, just like looking at the watch, it seems like it's about time for Amar to get going here. Looking at the field, he's very easily somebody you could see getting knocked out around this point, and it's a total reverse. And I started getting very worried for Marjorie towards the end of this episode. And I was gonna come on here and be very angry if it had gone that way.
Yeah, it's to the point, Josh, where I'm starting to think about you when these eliminations are made, because you've already lost so much in this game, Josh. And I don't know if you can take and sustain much more loss.
Well,
really,
you know, it's the kind of thing where, like, I didn't choose that family, you know, like I was kind of born into that family that I lost, and now I've chosen in your family, and I'm locked in, Antonio, so I'm happier. But if we lose the people that I truly love, then I'm going to be upset.
Yeah.
Well, not to mention, Josh's first team, all of them are at the bottom of this fan favorite poll as well, so I feel like they're not doing well in any capacity.
Yeah, we'll talk about this ongoing fan favorite poll, and if its results are as legitimate as the updates from the Instagram poll that they ran in the competition earlier this season. But we'll talk about that. But yeah, I think Top Chef's doing a good job with the editing and the stories. We've kind of discussed on this podcast how they tend to do a very good job of that throughout, that unlike other reality shows, they don't often tip their hat completely when it comes to their edit. And I think they're even getting better at it than they have been in previous seasons, where you get backstory on a chef and they don't necessarily go home that week. I think the thing to track is, does one of Marjorie or Amar go home next week? And was this the beginning of kind of the introduction of their character and their backstory right before they go home? Certainly the introduction to Amar's backstory this week set up his win, so that's great. But the introduction to Marjorie's kind of soup kitchen backstory did not set up a loss for her this week, so that's also great. And we end up with a lot of backstory and a lot of different chefs by the end of the season. So they do a really fantastic job with these edits, and I don't really think that anything is being telegraphed one way or the other. But we will see kind of what we get next week out of what we had last week. That said, we didn't get an especially deep backstory edit on Karen last week. So unfortunately, Karen does go home this episode. That is really kind of the headline.
Yeah.
Josh, do you want to eulogize Karen? Kurt is not here.
Yeah.
Where is Kurt, Mike? Do you have an idea where Kurt is, by the way?
I believe Kurt's sitting outside Carl's house right now with a sign that says, "You're my only hope."
Oh, I thought that you were going to say with like a boombox over his head.
Yeah, that's playing an MC Hammer song, or playing Carl's mixtape of MC Hammer. Yeah. I mean, I guess this is how it was meant to be, right? That all the weeds kind of got cleared out, and Kurt's one true love here of Carl is his last hope of winning this fantasy draft.
Yeah. I love Karen. I was sad to see Karen go. There was another person who was up for it that I really would have liked to have seen go in her place.
Jeremy!
We can talk about that later. But I mean, that being said, I understand why she went. You know, she really wanted to make Chinese food, and she really reached to make Chinese food. And, you know, she strayed too far away from the lanes of the challenge. You know, that said, the judges seemed to like everything that they were fed at the challenge. It's just a few of them were so clearly away from the core of the challenge. And probably in terms of the actual cooking, I feel like Marjorie probably screwed up the most. But I think that Karen was so far away from the challenge. She was supposed to be Japanese. She, you know, concocted this story about the Chinese influence on Japanese cooking, which I'm sure certainly exists. But that's not what you think of when you think of in this challenge. And I think that it became so transparent that she wished that she had drawn the Chinese food lot. So what are you going to do? That's the kind of thing that's going to get you kicked out of Top Chef. I'm sad because I loved my lady in pink. I thought Karen was great. I could have seen her going all the way, but it was not meant to be.
The pink dragon.
The pink dragon
is no more. She has breathed her last bit
only,
of pink
only
fire.
On Bravo do you get pink dragon as a rap name past the censors.
I had never at any way thought of that, Mike, until you just brought it up. So congrats
on
going full blown.
You have not seen How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Okay. So that's what it reminded me of.
Got it.
I have not. So I will I'm marking that down to supplement my Top Chef viewing experience. I need to go watch that movie. So I will do that. It seems a little Oaklandish to me, but we'll see what happens. We do end up in Oakland. We're going north of the Oakland and San Francisco Bay Area. We end up in Jack London Square in Oakland. I wish it was Jack Lemon Square. I had to rewind it to make sure that it wasn't. That would be a lot more fun for me if it was Jack Lemon Square. But no, we're in Jack London Square. And who do we have in Jack London Square? But we have MC Hammer. And Carl is over the moon about this. Mike, did you have Carl pegged as the most likely to have been a young rapper and making, you know, mixtapes and writing rhymes with his friends late at night inspired by MC Hammer?
I'm surprised he wasn't writing rhymes about how he was going to marry a woman that takes him down to Nicaragua, because that's pretty much all we knew about Carl before this moment. I mean, he definitely is this sort of, I could definitely imagine him. I don't know his upbringing, but I could totally imagine him as this like suburban kid who grew up, you know, in the 80s when hip hop was becoming a big thing. And he decided like, I'm going to be just like them. I'm going to start writing raps with my friends. The Hammer cameo itself was really interesting. I mean, I know we've seen random celebrity cameos in the past. I remember there was one challenge with Anna Faris and Chris Pratt. Like Lea Michele showed up for one. We talked earlier about the Charlize Theron challenge, but this one seemed probably like one of the most random, because I don't think Hammer has done anything significant outside of his bankruptcy in the past like 15 years.
He is kind of, you're right, but he is kind of Oakland's most famous, I think, as far as that goes. I think if you're looking for an Oakland celebrity cameo, it's definitely Hammer. And we got the backstory on where the nickname came from. If you weren't aware, he was nicknamed Hammer by Reggie Jackson because he looks like Hammer and Hank Aaron, or did when he was younger and when he was a bat boy for the Oakland A's. I'm wondering, Josh, if you met Reggie, if a young Josh Wiggler met Reggie Jackson, what celebrity would Reggie Jackson name you after and say you look like?
These days on the Twitters, I'd get a lot of Seth Rogen, Jonah Hill. Clark Duke is my personal favorite. I don't know.
So you'd be called the Duke, yeah. MC Duke.
MC Duke, yeah.
I'm not sure that that's a great name.
No, I don't think so.
This also is under the circumstances that Hank Aaron apparently is clairvoyant and can see who these celebrities are 20
well,
years
Clark
from now.
Duke, you know, he has the hot tub time machine, so he went back and he introduced himself.
MC Duke is here in the house, ready to drop some shitty rhymes.
Yeah, you're
so you know that'll play out the way it plays out. That's unfortunate. Mike, what about who would Reggie Jackson name you?
Well, I think you just call me MC, which is short for Michael Cera, because that's probably the one that I get the most.
Oh man, didn't Michael Cera and Clark Duke have like a web series?
Oh, if they did.
They did. I forget what it's called.
You and I can just do a remake of that in the year like 2025. Yeah.
Was it called the Judge's Table Podcast
no,
by any chance?
It was called Clark and Michael, and I advise you to look it up. A little NSFW, but it was a 2007 web series, and it was fun.
I will look for that now just to see if there are any Wiggler Bloom connections there.
Yeah.
That will be fantastic. Yeah. It does transition nicely, though, into what this quickfire challenge is, because in the quickfire challenge, we have Padma says something like, oh, we want to find out a little bit more about you as chefs and as people. So what we have to do in this quickfire challenge, what the chefs are asked to do, is come up with their rap name and then create a dish that personifies that rap name. So really, the vista is wide open here. The canvas is completely blank. They can paint whatever they want to paint on it. And the prize is immunity. So even with seven left, we're still going with immunity. That's pretty high stakes at this point in the game. And so we've got a nice slate of rap names that are created here. Anybody have a personal favorite that stands out?
Can we just burn them all? Can we?
Let's burn them all.
No, I want to burn Jeremy's especially because Spicy J-Rock 305 sounds like a Kansas radio station. It's just like a horrible, horrible, like I'm going to combine every worst part of any rap name and just smush them all together into one name.
It was so Frat Dad. It really was. I turned, you know, Frat Dad as anointed by the Up Rocks recaps. I turned to my wife while we were watching this and I was like, this is why he's Frat Dad, because he named himself Spicy J-Rock 305. Like that is such like, I'm a cool dad. I'm going to give myself a cool rap nickname and it's Spicy J-Rock 305 and the kids will love it. Unbelievable.
Sounds like you love Jeremy.
I'm
you?
A big fan, huge fan of Jeremy.
I liked Kwame's name. I feel like Kwame must be either a Game of Thrones fan or a Jordan Kalish fan with Baelish.
I know, that was great too. Yeah.
I was very disappointed.
Chaos is a platter.
Yes, that we didn't have chaos as a platter, that we didn't have a dish that pulled in. Chaos as a platter is fantastic. Like, yeah. Why didn't we get that?
I know. It sucks.
I don't know. It's disappointing.
Baelish was great. I thought I love Marjorie so much, so I'm just inclined to love everything she does. But Miss Punch-A-Lot, I thought was hysterical.
Yeah, I was going to mention last week that I definitely remembered that when Marjorie got excited about Restaurant Wars, she like punched somebody in the thigh. And I had completely forgotten to remark about that. But apparently it's been a recurring thing. And now I'm intrigued to kind of almost go back and watch some parts of previous episodes to see how much punching is actually shown on camera.
It really makes you want Marjorie to win so that we get the winner's montage with her just like punching the crap out of people.
I want her to win and then punch Tom in the face in excitement.
Yeah, we did it! Clonk it out!
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to get a nice little punch montage in the reunion show. They usually do a pretty good job of setting up the comedic relief for that. And I think that's going to be one of Marjorie's comic moments. All the punching that's going on. We already got a really nice sample of Miss Punch-A-Lot here. It is disappointing we didn't get more of a Game of Thrones tie-in with Baelish. I was really hoping we would have something, anything like that would tie in. But I don't know. We also have the pink dragon, Karen. We talked about this. Isaac is really just kind of sucking up, I think, to Hammer. I'm not sure how much Isaac knows about rap. He calls himself Toops Legit. And then Carl is Dr. Funky Fresh, which is pretty lame, I got to say.
Unbelievably lame. Dr. Funky
Well,
Fresh.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the perfectly prescribed name for a guy who grew up in the suburbs, once again, listening to MC Hammer mixtapes.
It's just great. Like, the glee that was on his face. He's like, yes, I get to meet MC Hammer, and I get to tell him that I'm Dr. Funky Fresh. It's just like, he's been waiting his whole life for this moment, and it was beautiful. It was a thing of beauty.
And I think, what's the only one we didn't talk about? Omar's, right? Santana Lover.
Santana, Mr. Lover, Lover.
Yeah.
Santana Lover. More backstory.
Yeah, more backstory. Amar is trying to win back the heart of his lady.
Yeah, so he talks about how he was with his girlfriend for, 3 years? And then they broke it off because he wanted to keep cooking and she basically wanted more of a commitment from him. But he vows on camera to win her back, which is, I don't know, pretty romantic gesture. It's not in the same lane as How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, uh-huh. But it's still pretty romantic by my standards.
Are there any analogs for this and how to Lose a Guy in 10 Days?
Not particularly from what I can remember, though. It's another excuse for me to watch that movie again, because man, is it fun.
Good stuff. That's sweet of Amar. Amar, a little bit of a romantic at heart. He seems like a big-hearted dude, so I like that story for him. I like that we got a little more personality out of him. I like him a lot. I feel like it's hard to imagine the scenario where he wins this thing, but I like having him on the show. I feel like he's just got a good sense of humor that's always been good and confessional and sort of just like getting good reactions out of the fellow chef testants. So good for Amar this week.
Yeah, and I like the authenticity. It's not that I don't like that Carl is authentically white, because that's shining through in this challenge. Bright light shining right off his white skin. talking about, he sees Hammer. I think his reaction is he says like, awesome sauce. And then, you know, he's really ready to bust out the rhymes when it comes down to it. And he really wants a beat. Like, he wants to rap. He's really excited to rap in front of Hammer, which, oh my gosh, my skin was crawling just thinking about this. And watching Carl do it made it crawl even more. So I appreciate that Carl is very authentically white as a person, just because it's hilarious. And it fits so perfectly with Kurt, with what, you know, Kurt likes on these shows. And it fits right into what we've kind of been joking talking about Kurt's archetype of reality contestant. And Kurt did do us the courtesy of sending along Kurt's own rap name. It fits right into this. Kurt, Mike or Josh, do you want to set up what Kurt's rap name and dish would be?
Yeah, Mike, do you have this?
I don't have it. I don't have it.
I have it. I have it. Kurt set up that his rap name would be White Noise, which is fantastic. Josh, what is White Noise's preferred dish?
White Noise would have served a dish that included an egg white omelet with white cheddar, chicken, specifying in parentheses light meat, white onions, and Pop Rocks.
I guess that's the noise part.
Yeah, that would be the noise.
Yeah, I can just imagine having a nice spoonful of eggs, chicken, and Pop Rocks to put into your mouth.
Yeah. You know, maybe there's something there that we don't know. Maybe White Noise has a vision that just goes beyond our wildest dreams.
Oh, I don't want to know about this white vision. This could be very troublemaking. I
think
the last time someone really bragged about their white vision, we had a giant world war about it.
No.
So we have to be very careful.
It's the final solution.
No,
no, Mike, come on.
No.
Yeah, that's too far, Mike. Come on, what are you doing?
Oh, come on. Yeah, only implications are we need on this
podcast.
Yes,
exactly. No, Kurt is...
Walk it back.
Kurt is mocking, of course, the Top Chef flyover states, the Midwestern Kurt, kind of the milquetoast white bread. You know, Kurt Clark's, he just tends to gravitate towards the nameless, faceless, plain people on these shows.
And, I love it.
And the egg white omelet with white cheddar and chicken, light meat chicken, until that, it sounds like something you might get at like a, I don't know, like boiled up at a nursing home. The Pop Rocks is a nice touch. The Pop Rocks is a nice touch. So that's at least something. But yeah, MC White Noise, not with us this week. He is probably outside Carl's house with the boombox doing something there. Mike, how about you? What's your rap name and what would your dish be?
Well, I luckily came into this with a rap name already ordained upon me from my previous appearances on RHAP. So I feel like I'd be betraying the countless number of fans that have asked me to, for some reason, to freestyle about Survivor if I didn't go with MC Blue Mizzle. And, you know, I guess if I'm having a dish that represents me personally, I feel like I have a very deceiving exterior considering the weird inner workings of my mind. So mine would probably be like a lean chicken breast that has like a jalapeno baked inside. So that when you cut in, you're very surprised at what might be in there and you're a little scared at the same time.
Spicy M-Rock.
Spicy M. What's your area code, Mike?
Spicy M. Rock 202.
Spicy. I would like to change it to Spicy Bloom Rock, but otherwise, let's keep it.
I have a myriad of names, so we'll just add that onto the
beautiful
pile.
I love it.
Josh, what about you?
I think it's pretty easily Wiggy Smalls. You know,
that's pretty strong.
I feel like that just happens. That happens kind of naturally. And then I would be making some sort of pizza thing. I don't know. Is there a good Biggie Smalls song title that works? Like Big Papa Pepperoni.
Yeah, that's pretty strong. Something with
you could do. I could do like a Tupac Biggie rivalry pizza.
A half and half.
Yeah, where it's West Coast flavors and East Coast
flavors.
Oh, that's
good. I like that. That's fun. Yeah, you could do like a juicy pizza, and it's like a pizza soup.
You lost me there.
Make sure that broth.
Well,
is thick
you're
enough.
In San Francisco. There's, you know, the sourdough is a big deal there. You could make some sort of bread bowl with pizza flavors, notes of pizza in there. I lost you.
Would you?
We're out.
Gosh,
we're out on
yeah,
that.
I was just wondering if you went to a restaurant and they had pizza soup and actual pizza on the menu. Are you getting the pizza soup?
It totally depends on the restaurant. Like if this is a tremendous restaurant, highly reviewed, revered, and they have pizza soup on there and it's like a bread bowl pizza type of deal and this place is just considered to be the bomb, of course I would check it out. How could I not?
I think.
What about you, Antonio? What do you have?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. I think that I would probably be like Tone Capone, maybe something like that. Tone Capone. That's it.
Or MCAC.
MCAC. You like that? But see, what would I make then? Something air conditioning based? I don't think that works with a dish. I would be Tone Capone.
You could make something like, cool.
Yeah. Well, this is I'm MCAC, and I'm
something
just a
where
cool,
you could adjust the temperature.
I'm
of
a
your
cool
dish.
Breeze looking at your mustache. No, yeah. I'm not going to be MCAC. I think that's like it doesn't work. I don't like that. I don't think you have to be an MC to be a rapper. I don't think that you need to put the MC in the front. I mean, none of our people were MCs in this competition.
We had some doctors.
Carl has a doctorate in rap.
Yeah, Carl had a doctorate. Well, I could be Dr. AC, but that would be different.
He's an MD, not an MC.
Yes, exactly. And to be an MC is what he chooses. No, I think I would be Tone Capone, and I would probably make something with mascarpone, like maybe mascarpone macaroni and cheese, like some comfort food there. I feel like that would go good. The Bayside, maybe put a little lobster in there, mascarpone lobster mac and cheese. And I feel like that would be in keeping with Tone Capone. I don't know. I like that. I like that we could have. I really do like Wiggy Smalls. I think that there's a lot of possibilities there with Biggie Smalls songs, because nobody else picks like an existing rapper,
right?
Except Isaac does go with Toops Legit, which is close to MC Hammer. Right. But he doesn't then make something pumps and a bump, you know, like of some kind of meal or something. Like, he doesn't make a hammer based meal. So I think that calling yourself Wiggy Smalls, you really do open yourself up to a lot of options. So
I feel like it's good. And, you know, there's few times when a last name like Wiggler is advantageous. So you got to seize those moments when they present themselves.
We really miss an opportunity to have Philip here, guys. I feel like I came up with a name for him. It's like two restaurants. It's like two chains, but two restaurants with a Z at the end of it. And all his dish is just a list of his printed out reviews from his various restaurant critics.
Two restaurants. I like it. I like it.
It's really funny. It'd have to be like a million restaurants.
Yeah, it's tough because Philip would have really, we talked a little bit about this at the beginning of the podcast. He would have had a lot of fun with this challenge, but it would have been terrible fun.
Well, I was going to say, no, people would have had a lot of fun with, yes, Philip. I don't think Philip would have had a lot of fun with this challenge.
He would have been like, well, my wife and I, we actually have a rap group. We produced our first EP on Kickstarter. We do all the beats, and we make all the, you know, we make all the rhymes. We just tried to get ahead of the hip hop scene there in LA. Like, I can just see Philip having an actual anecdote to tie this into, much like Carl or much like Kwame. Kwame, apparently, by the way, in addition to everything else that Kwame has done, Kwame was also a rapper at one point, but he was the rapper that had to provide you free food to come to his shows. Do you guys are both in New York. Do you get invited to those kind of gigs?
See, after he said that, now I'm afraid that there are random guys in Times Square that try to hand out their mixtape CDs to people on the street. Maybe there's a chance that I passed Kwame by a few years ago and I didn't even realize it. Now I'm sort of like playing my mind back, trying to think about all the possible rappers I passed on the street in Times Square.
You could
have
been friends with Kwame.
Yeah. Wait, so how old is Kwame, by the way? He's like 23, right?
He's like 47.
I was going to say, yeah, this guy seems like he has the life experience of like Joe Del Campo from Survivor, compacted in a 23-year-old man.
Yeah, Christine Raddus had tweeted at us and asked us who had more jobs, Debbie from Survivor or Kwame with a hashtag of Red Lobster. So Kwame has, what has he done? We know that he has tried to start a catering business by selling food on the subway.
Right.
We know that he was a really good drug dealer.
Right.
What else do we know? He worked at Kraft.
He worked at Kraft. He toured Asia for a while.
He lived in Louisiana. He lived in Louisiana for a time.
He used to be a rapper.
Yeah. He's got a lot of life experience. He's an interesting dude.
Yeah, Kwame for president.
Kwame for president. No, he's an interesting guy for sure. But yeah, as for the free food thing to get you to like a rap venue, I mean, I haven't experienced that. I've certainly experienced the come see my comedy show, we'll have sandwiches. Oh, yeah. Come to the comedy show, we've got nachos. Like, I've definitely had that happen before, and often it's a fairly tempting offer.
I have
a feeling you would attend a rap show that offered Punch and Pie.
That would actually be
a decent rap duo name, by the
punch
way.
Punch and Pie!
Punch and Pie. Marjorie! Yeah.
Miss Punch a Lot and Pie.
Yeah.
Actually, Marjorie Bakes, too. She can be Punch and Pie.
Oh, man. You can't say no to Punch and Pie.
Punch and Pie. Yeah, so that would be good. Kwame, we don't know what kind of food he was offering, but I think that that's really funny that he had a couple of mixtapes. He apparently tells Hammer that he DJs and he spits as well, so he's probably still working the turntables, working the ones and twos. We don't know what Kwame is doing in his free time that he probably doesn't have anymore now that he's moved to DC and started his own restaurant, but he is a man of many tastes. He does make Baelish. Let's talk about some of the dishes that tie into their rap name. So we had Santana Lover. We found out that he's really cooking a dish to win the heart back of his ex-girlfriend who broke up with him because he wanted to cook more than he wanted to get married. And it's a Chilean sea bass. with kind of an interesting soy glaze and a dashi broth. He doesn't win. He's in fact on the bottom of this challenge.
Not a great sign for his romantic prospects.
That's exactly right. Not looking great. Not, the arrow is not pointing up on that relationship for Santana Lova. Spicy J-Rock 305, a.k.a. Frat Dad. And he makes what? Chipotle halibut cheek and a Dungeness crab. We have a Dungeness crab broth off. Is that what we've got going here?
It seems to be. Dungeness crab, which is, you know, a big deal in the Bay Area. And Jeremy tries to rock with that a couple of times this week. And it's just like, you know, it's just kind of whatever.
Yeah, he was 1-1 in terms of soups this week. Or I guess I wouldn't even call it 1-1 because he was right in the middle. He wasn't top or bottom on the challenge. So he's like 1 and 0.5 right. And 1 in terms of making soups this week.
Soup's legit. Yeah, unfortunately, this soup is not legit. He makes
soup's unlegit.
Soup's unlegit. It doesn't work. It doesn't work very well for Kwame either. Kwame Baelish, he does basically the same thing. He's making kind of a, you know, the seafood broth with the Dungeness crab. It's a little thicker, a little creamier. He ends up at the bottom. Hammer says to Kwame that there were dishes that were similar, but that had more kick, and then doesn't really give Jeremy mad props. Jeremy doesn't make it into the top. So a dish that wasn't that great was still better than Kwame. So not the best quick fire showing for Chef Baelish. Toops Legit, however, does do really well. He makes some barbecue sauce scallops with some grits. It does seem legit Cajun. He gets comments about how it made him feel like they were at Mardi Gras. So I think that does fit right in with the legit theme. He does end up winning this challenge. Was this the food? Was this the food from this quickfire that you guys wanted to eat the most?
No.
What did you want to?
No, I mean, as much as the bread apparently soaked up the spices, I was all over Marjorie's fried chicken
sandwich. Completely. I was surprised that it performed so poorly. I probably would have left it anyway. But I'm not a huge scallops guy to begin with, so I was sort of down on Toops Legit's dish just for me personally, just from the jump. But even just looking at it, it looked like there wasn't a ton of scallop on there. It looked like kind of minimal scallop action on there, and yet everyone loved it. So, look, I'm not going to be mad at it. I love Isaac. I'm glad that Isaac got immunity this week. I'm glad that he is still doing really well out there. It just was definitely not, it would not have been on my board.
Stop it for 1 second. I had to clear my throat. I apologize.
I don't know.
And I also want to pull something up on Reddit because I read something really funny. And I just remembered it.
The Daenerys Targaryen theory?
No, somebody in the Top Chef Reddit said that Carl's chef name should have been Soigne West.
Well, he said his initial name was Soigne something Plouche. Soigne.
I was about Plouche, to get to that. That's why I wanted to do this. All right, I'm going to start back up here. Yeah, I definitely agree with you guys that chicken sandwich looked fantastic. And I'm a bread fan. So if it's got too much bread, that just means too much delicious. I don't think Marjorie made that bread on the spot. She probably used some kind of pre-existing bread. And I think that might have been a bigger part of her downfall, is that she didn't necessarily prep that bun specifically for the service. But that fried chicken sandwich with a honey sriracha glaze, I think you could throw a honey sriracha glaze on something truly disgusting and I would probably want to eat it.
Could you put it on Phillip's strawberry salad and it would make it taste better?
I'll eat that. I already kind of want to eat the strawberry salad as it is. So
don't tell Gail
You know, the first thing I tell Gail when I see her, Mike, is going to be that I want to eat Phillip's dish. So, but yeah, I do eat the honey sriracha glaze is a big hook for me. I know it's hip. I know sriracha is everywhere. I know Trader Joe's has like sriracha flavored, nasal decongestant.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that real?
No, it should be though, right? Like they have
that
sriracha.
That would definitely clear you up. Yeah. Remember that time, guys, when the apocalypse was upon us and the sriracha factory was shut down?
Yes, because it was producing noxious odors and it couldn't, you know, anybody that lived around it couldn't breathe.
It was Armageddon in both directions because it's releasing noxious toxic gas into the air and it's killing the people around the sriracha plant. But if we shut it down, no more sriracha. What do we do?
It's a lose-lose. That's the better of the few versus the better of the whole.
What was the resolution on that? Did they just decide to sacrifice the village?
Did it really kill people, Josh?
I don't think so.
Yeah, that was the Roanoke of the 2010s. What they just said, we're going to wipe this slate.
Yeah, they just found someone carved into a tree, sriracha.
Yeah, just a pepper. Yeah, like a chili pepper carved into a tree. Like
ghost
the last
pepper.
Thing.
Yeah,
yes, a ghost pepper. Nobody knows what happened to that village. It was just disappeared, so that we could all have sriracha. No, I think it was just.
Thank you for your noble sacrifice, Sriracha Village.
And thank you very much, Roanoke Sriracha. Yeah,
The Srirachians.
This is no more. We have Sriracha now. So you tell me what happened. It's part of the vast.
That's why I'm asking, because part of either the vast a sacrifice must have been made.
It was. I think they were just all relocated to a nicer village, one village over. Is this even a village? I thought it was like in a populated urban area.
I like my version of it better.
I like an M. Night Shyamalan-esque like colonial village.
The Sriracha Village.
Well, what is the twist at the end of that, Mike?
The twist is that sriracha the entire time was made out of the blood of a fairy that was put in the corner, run by mermaids that were dead the entire time.
That's complicated.
Very complicated.
Hard to follow.
There's a big twist at the end there, too. Yeah, so I don't know. Sriracha is in everything these days. I think it comes from Thailand, if I'm not mistaken. It is very popular in Vietnamese cuisine. But it has the Hoi Phong Foods is the U.S. distributor. So I think they've got their act together. And if not, they killed a whole bunch of people and just didn't tell us about it. And I guess either way, as long as we don't know, it doesn't matter, right?
I guess.
Yeah, that's history, much like the elimination challenge.
Yeah, so this is the history of what happens, and if it goes away, we'll know kind of what happens next. But yes, the sriracha honey glaze is a big deal. That was a huge hook for me. I wasn't as sold on the hot and sour soup of the Pink Dragon, even though it did get good reviews from the judges. It was, the spices were good. It really shone through. It just didn't really seem to hook me that much. Maybe if they were in like a colder area where it was like, you know, when the time when they were in Vancouver or Alaska, I would have been more in on the hot and sour soup. But it just really didn't hook me at that time. Speaking of hooks, Dr. Funky Fresh wants to sing the hook, or at least rap the verse. He's trying to come up with other rap names before Dr. Funky Fresh. He comes up with Soigne Plouche, which I don't know about Soigne Plouche. I really don't. Espute Bredeos, I'm sorry for the pronunciation there, Espute Bredeos on Reddit suggested it should have been Soigne West. That would have been pretty good. We could have got an unfinished dish that never comes out, except for if you do subscribe to some crazy service, you can eat a little bit of the recipe.
Yeah. Or Carl makes a dish that puts himself $1 million in debt.
I need you guys to pay for my food.
Yeah. Get Zuckerberg over here. Get him across the bay. Why isn't he here eating my food?
Yeah.
And I can totally imagine Carl's restaurant front is designed like the cover of The Life of Pablo. Just a bunch like Carl's restaurant and a bunch of different type settings over
his
each
restaurant is called Title.
Exactly. Yeah. Here's the title. No one shows up. Well, it's the number one most downloaded app. So some people show up, but nobody wants to. Like nobody wants to eat there actively, but people feel like they have to.
Yeah, I hear it's something I got to do. So.
And I heard actually in unaired footage in this episode, Carl actually stopped the elimination challenge after Amar won to say that Kwame had the best dish of all time.
But Kwame had the best dish of all time.
Kwame had one of the best recipes of all time. I'm going to let you finish. I'm going to let you finish, Amar. I'm going to let you finish.
I think we just made Carl infinitely more interesting now, talking about him as Kanye West analog.
Kurt doesn't want him on his team anymore, guys. Yeah. Kurt wants Jeremy. He's offered a trade.
Oh, man.
Dr. Funky Fresh, he has the guts to rap for Hammer, and I got to say, he does a terrible job.
Yeah, it's not good.
No, not great, Bob. He does not. I mean, it made my skin crawl watching it happen. I don't know why, but I did not feel comfortable witnessing that assault on rap music in front of MC Hammer. But, you know, he tries. So good for him, I guess. It takes a lot of guts. And Hammer kind of takes it in stride. Are you bribing the judges? As though making a bad rap song in front of Hammer would be considered a form of a bribe.
Are you bribing the judges? Can you please? I'm still in debt. Yeah.
Speaking of Kanye's lessons. So that's what we got here. We were leaving out one thing that happens in this elimination challenge. We get the next chapter in the romance that is Kwame and Padma. Does anybody want to set that up? What happens here?
Well, first of all, is their shipping name Padme?
It is, unfortunately.
Remember when we called her Padme during the Grease Live podcast, Mike?
Yes, we did.
My bad.
Is this the second or third episode in the Padme relationship
this
here?
This is episode 3. It's close to the end.
Yeah, so this is the...
Yeah, so Padme's going to die in childbirth at the end of this episode.
This is the one that's not that bad. That's kind of decent, I guess,
no,
this chapter here.
No, you only think it's not that bad because you were desperate, but when you go back and you look, it really is terrible.
No, it really is terrible. Except for this is kind of a fun moment here. We know that Kwame has this pre-existing weakness for Padme. There's just doesn't seem to be much Kwame wouldn't do for Padme. And I can't really say I blame him. When she's wearing a yellow shirt here in this challenge, when Padme wears yellow, she looks fantastic all the time, but yellow is a really great color on her. And I don't know, seeing her in the natural light standing outdoors, Kwame is swept away. And so Padme sort of, you know, Padme does what all very attractive women do when they know that a man has a crush on them. She pushes him into doing something embarrassing and extending beyond his comfort zone a little bit, rapping in front of Hammer. He doesn't seem to really want to do it. Carl has already done it, so this is kind of sad and embarrassing. But Kwame gets a kiss out of it.
Oh, I love it. And I love the how, again, the editors totally buy into it. They play like the pseudo softcore porn music in the background when, you know, Padme says, oh, Kwame, you should rap. And I just love how the editors are totally steering into the curve with this. And how everyone is also paying attention to it and like making fun of him for getting a kiss as well. So one of the many reasons why I hope Kwame continues to go far in this competition is just to see how their relationship develops. I want Kwame and Marjorie to be crowned co-top chef so that Marjorie can punch Tom in the face and Kwame can make out with Padme as the confetti falls.
Why didn't Carl get a kiss, Josh?
I don't know, because his name is Funky Fresh. It's like, I don't want to kiss that. That might be smelly.
Yeah, that sounds like something that would go through Padma's head, for sure. I buy that. But yeah, Kwame gets a kiss where Carl doesn't. And maybe it's because Padme pushed him into it and she strong-armed him into it. I don't know. But his rap isn't that much better than Carl's, let's be real. He tries. It's a little more along the lines of a freestyle, whereas you feel like Carl was really thinking his up the entire time, just waiting for the opportunity to spit it out. Kwame does seem pressed into service and does a little bit of a rap. It's not as bad as Carl's. It's not as awkward or skin crawling as Carl's, because it very clearly is more on the spot, where Carl has really tried to create something that he busts out there for Hammer. And Kwame gets a kiss at the end, so good for Kwame. He wins.
Yeah, I mean, listen, this quickfire was so strange. I mean, it's given us great fodder for podcasting, and it's very funny, but probably funny for, I don't know if it's funny for the reasons that the people behind Top Chef wanted it to be funny for. I don't know. I would probably advise against ever seeing this challenge on Top Chef again. I'm glad it happened, but what a weird challenge to like have everybody be like, make yourself a rapper, come up with a rapper name, embarrass yourself horribly on national television.
Yeah, it's not great. It is not great. And it's really funny, ultimately, that we do see when Isaac wins, he does a little bit of a Hammer dance. And Amar had already done a little bit of a Hammer dance to a pretty good laugh. But Isaac's kind of remark about this is like, I won. I didn't even have to rap. It's like, you know, I didn't even have to like make a fool out of myself to win a food challenge. What are the odds that I could actually win just based on my food? Who knows? And he says booyah, but he doesn't even feel good about saying that. He just says booyah. So
booyah.
Like he doesn't really booyah. Like he doesn't really, you know, he's giving it the Cajun twist. And he does a little Hammer dance and he wins. And that's great. He didn't even have to rap. So yeah, he didn't have to subject himself to that humiliation. He got to make some dish that was legit to what he makes, and he won. Isaac on a little bit of a roll here.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were talking last week about Isaac's rising stock, and we were questioning whether he had the capacity to keep going with this or if he would just fall apart when put in an environment outside Restaurant Wars. And he seems to be doing pretty good. I mean, he ended up right in the middle of the elimination challenge, but I mean, his stock is definitely rising here. And I would maybe consider him a contender to win at this point, especially with Karen gone.
Yeah. This is kind of, he kind of talks about how he's getting into his comfort zone, finding his second wind. I, I, I love Isaac. He was my number one draft pick in the draft that we did earlier this year. He never has struck me as not a contender to win, but he's never also really struck me as the favorite. And I still don't think he's there. He cooked a dish that he got good comments on at the Elimination Challenge, but didn't make it into the top three. He's not really striking me still as a favorite, even though I'm not sure we have a favorite. I think we'll talk about that after the results of the Elimination Challenge. I think the field's a little wide open, really. And it's hard to tell from the edit exactly who's winning and who's going home from week to week. So Isaac, I guess, has as good a shot as anybody. This is a great time to be finding your stride. And he does find his stride, gets immunity in the Elimination Challenge, which doesn't seem to have mattered for him, but it seems like the kind of Elimination Challenge where immunity would give you a lot more latitude. We find out pretty quickly what the challenge is. Jonathan Waxman, famous chef from California, walks in. Amar just is in love. He says he's got all of his books. This is kind of a time and place competition. I'm not sure why it has to take place in the Bay Area. There doesn't seem to be much of a tie-in except for one of the time periods is the San Francisco Gold Rush. But other than that, there doesn't really seem to be a tie-in to the Bay Area itself. But the chefs had to randomly draw knives. And after they randomly draw knives, they get to pick from a globe with time and place, specific cultures and cuisines that they're going to be basing their cuisines on. Sorry, cultures. And Isaac, you know, picks first and picks the Vikings. And then we go through the rest of the list. Did any of these jump out to you guys as like definite ones to avoid?
I think that for me, it would be really difficult to cook Indian food for Padma. You know, I feel like mm-hmm. that would be something that she'd be super discerning on. And you really got to be so, so confident that you can knock it out of the park if you're going to do that. So I was surprised by Marjorie's pick. And she picked, I feel like, fairly early, or at least when there were still decent options on the board.
Yeah. Yeah, she picked Indian over Chinese, which is interesting to me. The one I would probably avoid was just the San Francisco Gold Rush, because again, they get this time to look things up in the library afterwards. But I feel like even just looking at everything on paper, not even knowing too much about the cuisines from the various time periods, I'd look at, you know, 1800s America and say, I don't even remember what food they were having back then. Whereas I know what Chinese food is, what Japanese food is, what French food is. So I'd rather take the food that I know over this sort of mystery cuisine, even if it is American.
I think go ahead. Yeah. No, I don't have anything groundbreaking.
Well, so. I mean, I think that's true. I actually was a little concerned about the Belle Epoque French cuisine, because I feel like that is one that everybody does know. And so I feel like your margin of error is very low on that. People are going to come in with a very specific expectation of what that cuisine should be. And if you fail at that, it's going to be very noticeable. Whereas if you come in with, like, let's say Viking cuisine, and you offer something that is, I don't know, let's say just in the realm of Viking, a giant piece of roasted meat with minimal spices on it, that is plated in a way that is more beefsteak than refined, I think that you're going to get a pass, and I think that's an easy one. I think picking Belle Epoque France, everyone has a very specific thing in their mind of what that food should be, and I think that that is great, because it sets up very easy expectation for you. But it also is very difficult, because you're painted into that very specific expectation. So I thought that that was a huge risk at the time when Amara picked it, even though he felt comfortable with it. That felt like as big a risk to me as the Indian food, which also did feel like a risk.
Yeah, I thought that Viking food going first off the board would not have happened if it wasn't Isaac picking first. Like, you know, yep. That's just such an Isaac move. It's like, all right, I kind of vaguely look like I could be a Viking. I like meat. I gotta imagine they liked meat, and I could just like toss some meat onto a wooden board and everyone will be happy.
And part of me kind of feels like Viking was a way for the judges to say, okay, do beefsteak again, but do it right this time.
Yeah, and Isaac does get kind of a quick line where he's like, you know, I think of horns of mead and meat roasted over fire and wenches and shit. Like, it's just, that's the, that he just is. Right.
There was a lot of shit during that time. Not a lot of plumbing back then.
Gross, Mike. Just gross. Yeah.
It's true.
Thankfully, that didn't make it onto the plate that we know of. So that was, you're right. It was kind of a layup pick for Isaac to pick Vikings. It made sense. It is, like I said, it's one of those things where you can pretty much nail the concept right away. You don't have to do a ton of research, except you don't want to, you don't want to include a bunch of spices or things that they probably wouldn't have included on their cuisine. But past that, I feel like you've already got it in your mind what to do, and it's a pretty easy thing to do. Carl picked ancient Greece second, which struck me as interesting. I think he wanted to cook Greek food. We know Carl does like Mediterranean flavors and likes cooking Mediterranean food and is good with it. We've seen him have a lot of success with that. So that pick made sense to me. Amar picking Paris, as we've talked about, it's difficult, but it made sense because Amar is classically trained in this French style. He knows how to do the sauces. He knows how to do the things that are at the heart of this cuisine, and it's something that he really wanted to do. So that makes sense. Marjorie picking ancient India, I don't know. We find out that Marjorie at age 25 had been a personal chef to an Indian family in Florida and had learned their recipes. I somehow doubt that they were ancient Indian recipes from the Indus Valley, specifically in northern India. So I think she is in a very more in a much more narrow kind of range there. But that makes sense why she would pick that. Kwame took China, which Karen really wanted, and we'll talk about that. Was ultimately her downfall. Jeremy picks the San Fran Gold Rush, bro, and Karen picks the Empire of Japan. Not great for Karen at the end of the day. We get into this. Instead of a shopping montage, we get a library montage. Do you guys prefer the library montage or the shopping montage?
I mean, it was fun to at least find out. Again, this is another time when we got some backstory from chefs. I mean, we found out from Karen that she minored in women's studies in college specifically because she was able to find other queer women. I guess that's the equivalent of like the boy taking ballet class so he can meet a bunch of girls and be the only boy in class. And we found out, probably to build the case against Jeremy in Josh's eyes, we found out that Jeremy didn't really do much in terms of academics, but he got to take surf class.
Yeah, I loved that. He's like, but I took surf class.
He wanted to make it to California for the Golden Rush, guys.
The Golden Rush.
Guys.
Oh, it was God. A golden rush.
Yeah, Mike, don't touch that one. And it was, it was,
nope. Yeah, it was, can't touch this.
I love Marjorie. Just correct. Stop. Marjorie was just like Gold Rush. I love Marjorie. Yeah. I love her deadpan correcting Jeremy in that moment. Jeremy does find an old menu from kind of one of the first places to open in San Francisco. I think this is really cool. I actually think that this is kind of a really great challenge in that way. When we did a little research, we did discover like a really old menu. I'm left thinking that Jason would have just loved this challenge, though. This is like,
oh, he would have.
Jason, they shouldn't have gone to the library. They should have just asked Jason. They should have had like one-on-one interviews.
Well, I'm
interviews.
Surprised that he wasn't just there. I feel like Jason would just like live in the library. Yeah,
in the food
he just
history
strikes
section.
Me as the type. Yeah. Can we go back to what Jeremy found? Do you remember one of the things that he found? It was like brains, tomato, and toast.
Yeah,
or something like that,
fried
right?
Brains, tomato, and toast. It was like a brains LT.
Why on God's green earth would you not make that? Like you have a menu, you found this crazy sounding thing on a menu, you're on Top Chef. If you can bang out a badass fried brains, tomato, and toast dish, you're going to win that competition for sure. I was really shocked that he didn't go in that direction. I think that's absolutely the way to go instead of making some rinky-dink chowder.
Rinky-dink.
Well, it goes to show what Jonathan Waxman says during the elimination challenge. He says, it seems like you don't want to step outside your comfort zone. And Jeremy fully admits to that. And I think this is a good case of that where he says, oh, yeah, you know, I guess they had a lot of New England influences because history lesson here. People traveled from the east to the west to get gold during that time period. And so they brought a lot of their New England flavors. And he says, I'm going to make a chowder.
Chowder.
I'm not actually going to make it. I'll kill you. I'm not going to make a chowder. I'm going to just do my own thing and make a really like light soup with a couple pieces of meat in it. So I feel like from the get-go, I agree, Josh. Looking at that menu, Jeremy says, you know what? I like soup. I'm going to make soup. And I feel like that's very indicative of just how he approaches a lot of these challenges. I don't know how much thinking outside the box Jeremy has
well,
done.
Well, and it's funny because he is really sort of hindered by his own problems. Because, look, he cooks in Miami. Miami cuisine is not going to be heavy. People don't want super creamy, thick, like fatty kind of things like that. It is a much more refined kind of thing down there. And it's interesting because in the elimination area, in the quickfire, he's sort of criticizing Kwame for making a seafood broth with a lot of heavy cream. And then when we get to the elimination challenge, when he makes his chowder, he doesn't use enough heavy cream. He makes this sort of thin, refined chowder that isn't the sort of thick, hearty, meaty kind of chowder that people were expecting and that you would probably, you know, you're not going to get like the Atkins diet chowder in the Gold Rush. It's not going to happen. But in South Beach, I mean, of course, that's what Jeremy's going to be expected to cook. And so he really is sort of hindered by his own sort of drawbacks and what he's bringing to the table. And that's certainly the kind of story that is told with Karen in terms of the elimination challenge, where she's trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. But I think Jeremy's definitely guilty of it as well. And he's guilty of it in the quickfire. And that's where it's kind of signaled that this is going to happen. So I think that this is interesting. It does not. I mean, the best thing about Chowder is not present in Jeremy's dish, and that's really tough. And it's a tough sell. I'm surprised that he didn't go home for this dish. But yeah, you're right. How does he not do the BLT, the brains LT?
It's such a cool concept, and like the fact that you could wave a page from the library in front of Tom Colicchio's face and say, "This is a thing. This happened. This was in the Golden Rush." He could say this stuff, and if he cooks it well, if he comes up with a really inventive take on that idea, I feel like that dish could really rock it. So could even Jay rock it if he tried.
Yeah, and I think that this is tough because I think that Jeremy's got to make it to the end in order to win Top Chef. And I think that there's no question from what we've seen for Jeremy that when his food is appropriate for the challenge and when he's able to kind of cook it in that little zone, he's done really well in this competition. He's won a few challenges. He's really shown in some of those areas. He's even used some of those Miami tricks to win quick fires or elimination challenges with ice on seafood ceviches and things like that on a hot day in Palm Springs. So we know that he's got that in his skill set, but he's got to make it to the end in order to win. And we're getting down to the nitty gritty here, where you have to really be able to expand beyond your comfort zone, and you have to be able to do something creative or different in order to exceed and not just succeed. And I think Jeremy's really running up against that. And we could see Jeremy go home, you know, cook his way through Last Chance Kitchen and come back into the competition. Sure. But I think he's going to find it increasingly more and more difficult to kind of just do what he wants to do and succeed in this competition. He's got to make what he wants to do something complicated. Speaking of doing what he wants to do, though, how did you feel about this little scene where they go to a tiki bar, the Tonga Room in San Francisco, and they get on a float and play drums and just blow up everyone at that place's spot, everyone that's going there for a quiet drink? All of a sudden, you've got these really annoying Top Chef contestants there. I don't know. I wondered why that was in there. It's just a slice of life. We don't get the hotel or house kind of scenes anymore because they're on the run so much. So we get this slice of life here from them at the Tonga Room.
Well, I get the sense from what I know about the Tonga Room that that's not a place where you're going for like a leisurely drink or like a, you know, like a really quiet conversation. It was featured heavily on a Bourdain episode a couple years back. It's a very visually memorable bar and establishment. I don't think it's like party central, but it's definitely got like that tiki vibe of like, you know, sweet cocktails and things like that. And everyone just kind of rocking out. So I'm not a big Jeremy fan, as has been made clear, but I can't knock him too much. He's, you know, he is surf frat bro dad, and this is kind of his scene. So of course he's just going to be maximum Jeremy here.
Wow, a guy named Josh doesn't like a guy named Jeremy. Where have I heard this before?
Yeah, it didn't strike me as a rocking out place. They just said it had a real throwback vibe. When I hear throwback, I think of chill and relaxed. And it was really low lighting. And yeah, it's a tiki bar, but it just didn't seem like there was a lot of partying going on there. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. It sounds like I am wrong, so that's fine. It sounds like they fit right in the Tonga Room. And Jeremy made everybody have a better time. So good for you, Fred, Dad. Good for you, Jeremy. But yeah, everybody else got in on the fun. Isaac was playing the cowbell. They all kind of jumped in there, and we just had that little scene there. And then we get some more backstory as we're prepping for the elimination challenge. That's when we find out that Marjorie knows the ways of the Indian recipes, that Amar has no room for error, but really understands. We find out that Isaac maybe doesn't know as much about what he's doing. He's reading the package, Mike.
I love that. I mean, you gotta love Isaac's confessionals, because it's almost like they're not scripted, obviously, but it seems like they're written out like they're talking heads on the Office or on Parks and Rec, where he says, you know, I do this advanced cooking technique where if I've never cooked it before, I just read the back of the package. So I love that. It's interesting that apparently the Han Dynasty used 4 ingredients or had like a small list of foods that they actually ended up using. And so Kwame is sort of handcuffed by that. And he's even more handcuffed by the fact that he did not cook his duck all the way through when he's showing
that
it
was
off to
awkward.
The judges.
Josh, did you feel for Kwame in that moment? We got Tom and Chef Waxman are kind of showing up there, and he's got a taster ready. He's got a test, and Tom wants some. And then what happens? Oh boy.
It's just you know, it's just the continuing tale of sad Kwame. You know, he's just been, ever since he opened up his heart and told us that story about how he didn't get along well with his father several years ago, he's just been sad Kwame ever since. I mean, we get a little happy Kwame at the end of this thing. He does well in the challenge. But in this moment, serving this, like, you know, carving up this sample duck with raw meat. It's not even rare. Some of that is just straight up raw. It was brutal. It was really, really tough to watch if you like Kwame. And how can you not like Kwame, even if you're not loving what he's doing right now on the show?
It was tough, especially when he's like, "Well, I could cut you off a piece of the top." And Tom just says, "No, I don't want it."
Yeah, although I gotta say, if being sad gets you a kiss from Padma, like, I'll just be Emily Dickinson on this mother. Like, just, I'll do whatever it takes. Like, I can be very sad. Believe me.
That seems extreme. I feel like that's not gonna work.
I feel
out
like
so well.
Many movies are based around this very premise, where a dude acts sad to get a chick or something. So, I mean, it seemed to have worked well for Kwame. You got a little kiss from Padma. So if that works, then, you know, sign me up. So, yeah, you're right, though. It's more than anything, it's embarrassing. And Kwame is like, "I'm embarrassed." And it's very, I don't know. He cooks his duck for 16 minutes. It's tremendously overcooked or undercooked. And he suggests for Tom, "I can put it back in." Tom's like, "Don't worry about it." Oof, that's really rough.
Yeah.
Though, imagine, again, Philip in this scenario. No, it's meant to be raw because it represents the raw emotions that are lying inside each animal.
Well, this becomes a point of debate, really. And it really comes to bear most in Marjorie's food, which is that palates, especially what people desired from a cooking of meat, they've varied over the years. And that not every culture is going to want a rare meat or a medium rare meat. They're probably going to cook the crap out of it. And so where do you draw that line with the judges? Do you cook them gross kind of hammered duck because that's what would have been expected at the time? Marjorie gets nailed a little bit for not cooking her lamb to a more well done kind of way and cooking rare lamb or not. Yeah, cooking rare lamb. And I think that's tough because every instinct as a chef is, "I'm going to cook this so that it tastes good." But maybe what we would think about cuisine at a certain time, Josh, I think we're going to talk about this later in the day. Maybe cuisine at another time tastes better or tastes worse. And so, you know, it's a very difficult thing to put your neck out there and not cook good tasting food. When it comes to cooking meat like that, cooking all the juices out of it, maybe that's what they would have done. But it's really hard as a chef to say, "I'm just going to hammer the crap out of this duck or this lamb." Just because they would have done that in this culture at the time. I think that's very tough.
I think that you can't think of it as a consideration too much. Like, how hard are you going to consider the fact that the judges are going to nail you on historical accuracy? Like, are they historians? Have they been spending the past several weeks in the library reading up on, you know, this ancient Indian cuisine? Like, they're going to know so thoroughly that this has to be pulverized meat. Like, I think that you have to bank on making a really, really tasty version, well-executed version of your dish. And I think that has to be the top consideration while staying as closely within the lanes of your cuisine as humanly possible. But I don't think that you want to go down the road of like, "Well, back in, you know, like however many thousand BC, they had, you know, really, really well done meat and they just burned the crap out of it." I don't think you want to go down that road. Apparently, some of these judges wished that she had. That's kind of crazy.
I think so too.
What do you guys make of the bread that she chooses to cook? The paratha, parata, pirana? I'm not sure exactly what it's called, but I mean, she's trying to, I guess, give her own spin on it by saying, "Hey, I can bake, let me make this bread." But I feel like even more than the charring of the lamb, the bread was a big sticking point and put her in the bottom.
I don't know why it made it off the table, personally. She didn't need it.
I think that one of the things that Marjorie's done so well is baking. You know, she's like, this has been something that she's become really known for, that she can, you know, she could just like dump some like monkey bread, some savory monkey bread on the table. And everyone's like, "Wow, this is incredible. I had no idea that this was coming my way. What a treat." And this has been one of her hallmarks on Top Chef. So, of course, she wants to make really good Indian bread. Indian bread is amazing when you have really good versions of it. I think that, Antonio, what you just said is totally honest. Like, at a certain point, you got to know it's not working out and you can't serve this anymore. So maybe it just should not have wound up on the table at all. In terms of the effort, the attempt to do it, I totally get where Marjorie's coming from, because this is her thing. If she can nail this, then it's a really awesome thing for her to nail. She just didn't. It just did not work out.
The bread was not a central component of the dish. It was in a separate bowl on the table, separate from her dish, which in
Marjorie and Carl do serve first. Marjorie serving the lamb kebab with a heart jus and curried split peas, and the bread is separate. And her dish itself looks very good. It sounds very good. The bread is in a different bowl, so I just don't know why the bread made it to the table. It wasn't a central part of the dish. She didn't have to serve it that way. She went for it, and I think she knew that it was bad. She knew that it was off. She knew that it was wrong. She knew that she didn't focus on it enough, and still put it out there. And I just feel like she didn't need it in the dish. It wasn't a central, like, it wasn't a vessel for anything. There was a kebab there. Like, there were utensils. So I'm not really sure why that ultimately happened. She wasn't making Ethiopian food and then screwing up the bread. This was a separate bread that, in her signature, as you're pointing out, that she's done. She's made separate breads, thrown them down to the table, no problem. This one just didn't need to make it to the table, I don't think.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of times in Indian cuisine, like, you can have bread be like an essential vehicle where you are using it as a utensil, and that's an amazing thing, and it's really, really delicious. But this did not seem like that.
It wasn't like she was sapping up her chicken tandoori or whatever, you know. It just wasn't
exactly.
It didn't play that way.
Yeah. And I don't even know what clarified butter is, but it seemed like she wasn't making it the right way, because she kept, like, the pot kept smoking and she kept having to pour it from pot to pot. So I feel like, even though she said I had made this before, I feel like she was getting more and more nervous about it as the cooking time went along. And I completely agree with you guys. I don't know why the bread made it onto the table at the end of the day. I feel like, even though the lamb wasn't charred, I feel like the kebab was enough.
Yeah, I've had
to speak
that bread before, and it didn't. I mean, I promise you, it just didn't look right. Like, it didn't. I think Marjorie knew, in fact, that it wasn't how she wanted it. And I think the ghee can be a difficult ingredient to work with, because I think you want to treat it like butter, but it's a little bit different to work with. So I understand where she struggled, and she kind of admitted that she didn't spend enough time focusing on it, that if with a little more time, she could have hammered it out a little better or worked on it a little better. She thought she could just go in and take one shot at it and make it. And it certainly didn't come out that way. So that was a difficult call for her. And it is tough when you're cooking in a judge's kind of wheelhouse. You have to also keep in mind that Padma does know this food. Padma is not the most, she's not the most worldly chef when it comes to knowing a ton of different kinds of cuisines really well. She's not known as a chef, period. She does have a couple of cookbooks. It's unquestionable that Padma can cook, but she didn't make her reputation on being a chef. But this is something that she knows. And anytime I think you give Padma the opportunity to show her bona fides in this realm, she's going to do it. And I think that you have to consider that. You have to kind of play game theory on the challenge a little bit. And I think Marjorie was cognizant of the fact that cooking Indian for Padma was a risk. But I think that in light of that, I think she should have been very careful about what she put out there in general. Carl didn't have that luxury. Didn't matter, though, because Carl's dish was kind of one dish, and it was very refined with mackerel and calamari and olives and grapes and some Sicilian spices. It was a little sweet for Greek food, apparently, but I think people were very pleased with that dish. It made it into the top in the elimination challenge, and it seemed in keeping. Even talked about how they had to trade with Sicily for the specific spice. It seemed in keeping with the time period. It didn't seem to be, you know, everything that we know about Greek cuisine, but a lot of what we think. So I think that worked really well for Carl. That seemed like a good choice, and it seemed like he did really well with it.
Mm-hmm. And I know a couple of listeners has said, oh, you guys are sleeping on Carl. He hasn't landed in the bottom yet. And that's true. I'm personally saying that, like, I could see Homeboy making it to, like, top 5, 4, maybe even 3. But I don't think he's making it to the finals or winning. I still think he still hasn't won anything. I think he's producing solid food, but nothing remarkable enough to net him any sort of win. And I feel like that speaks volumes about his competition in general. So I can see him, again, solidly cooking for the next few weeks. Again, this week he was finished in the top in both quickfire and elimination, so he's clearly very solid. But I don't think he's done anything extremely outstanding that's made him a big contender to win.
That said,
opinion.
I look forward to Dr. Funky Fresh's album dropping on Tidal in the near future.
I will sign up for Tidal and get that if it happens. You're right. I think you're right. Carl is not the definition of, like, a floater, although I think that that's probably what his gameplay is resembling. He's not sticking his neck out and getting exposed negatively, and he's not really sticking his neck out and going for the win. So he's cooking good enough food that's not getting him eliminated. I think that after one or two more episodes, he's going to reach a point where that's not enough. And there, you know, are going to be three people at the top and three people at the bottom in the next episode. So he's either going top or bottom next episode. And I think that, you know, going forward from there, I think it's going to be difficult to just cook good but not great food and not get sent home after a point. I think everybody's going to start doing that, and he's going to have to step his game up. That said, I do think that he has it in him to step his game up. I don't think we've seen everything that Carl can do. I think he started really well on this show. With the carrot soup that he made and the Mediterranean flavors. I really don't say that I've seen like the, I don't think I've seen the quintessential Carl dish yet, where we've seen Isaac cook, you know, the quintessential Cajun food or in his wheelhouse. We've seen Marjorie do the things she's really good at. We've seen other chefs win with what they're really good at. We haven't seen that from Carl yet. So I think that time could be coming, but I agree. I just don't think he doesn't strike me as winner material because he's not really stepping outside that comfort zone. So, you know, at a certain point, I think he's going to get exposed for doing very good, but not really, you know, elevated kind of food. We'll see. Kwame and Isaac are also, the in that kind of realm, although Isaac is cooking kind of what he does well. He's won for it. In this particular instance, he's cooking this venison loin with a grotter porridge. It does seem to be well researched. He plates it on wood, which even for Isaac is a little bit twee, I think. There's no tweezers involved, but it's a little bit of a gimmick, I think. And it's not a gimmick that is ill-received, but it also doesn't get him the win or even into the top three. So he makes good food here. Gail specifically cites it as one of the foods that she really, really liked. But he does seem to do pretty well with this challenge. And then Kwame, he does manage to cook his duck well, and he gets really good comments for it. So good for him.
Yeah, this is, and again, we were talking about Gregory upside last week, and this may be the inklings towards a Kwame redemption story a little bit. Maybe this challenge, he's, even though he didn't win, he's walking away in the top once more, and maybe he feels like he's in his wheelhouse again in terms of cooking good food that satisfies everybody. So I don't know. I mean, next week, not to spoil too much, but it looks like the challenge involves purposeful sabotage from other people. So maybe Kwame will become sad Kwame once again, but I'm hoping Happy Kwame is here to stay.
Start for MC yeah. Blizzard, MC Blue Mizzard. We can make that happen.
That's a great album.
Baelish. Happy Kwame is here to stay. Oh, I love Kwame. You know, he's like, I think Kanye could take a note for that. We need Happy Kanye.
Yes. Yeah, Happy Kanye.
I hate the old Kwame. I want the new Kwame.
I just made the biggest mistake of my life. I just crushed Kwame in a rap battle.
That could go really well. It could go really well for Kwame if he finds his happiness. And if he, you know, maybe it takes a rap battle to do that. Who knows? Maybe winning the kiss from Padma instead of Carl getting it is enough to buoy Kwame up here and push him to the finish line, because he does really well with his dish. It's interesting because the top in this challenge, and Amar serves his French food. We'll get to Karen and Jeremy in a moment, but Amar serves his French food, and it's fantastically well received. Everything about it is how it should be. He makes the truffle sauce in 3 hours to get the kind of flavor he gets out of the sauce is impressive to all the chefs. Everyone's a really big fan of the richness and concentration of the dish. He makes sweetbreads and squab and foie gras. He's just got all these really rich and really awesome foods in there, and it's really well received. So he's in the top along with Amar, along with Carl and Kwame. And, you know, Kwame, what they say is he showed great restraint, that he only used a few ingredients, that he didn't go crazy with it. For Carl, they say he had great design and balance to his dish. And for Amar, it was great technique, showing pro moves. So good for them for being in the top for three very different things that it takes, I think, to make a successful dish. We've got restraint, technique, and design and balance. For the bottom, though, and Jeremy and Karen both end up there. Jeremy makes a chowder that we've talked about. It's too refined. There's not enough crab in it. It's not what the judges expect. And it's not a brains and tomato and toast. So it doesn't necessarily, it's not really evocative of anything. It's a weird Miami refined chowder. And for Karen, it's evocative of the wrong thing. It's a Chinese dish. If it had just been the soba noodles and the dashi broth, it probably would have been fine. The food tastes good, but conceptually it's a mess. And I think it shows, you know, the downside of what you can do in a challenge like this. We see ultimately that Jeremy was too sophisticated, that Karen was overcomplicated, and that Marjorie, you know, just her, she had some execution issues. She didn't get enough char in her lamb. It wasn't fatty enough. The bread was greasy. So we have kind of the opposite of what it takes to be a good chef. We have poor execution, poor concept, poor design. So it is really kind of a fascinating setup for the top three and the bottom three, because each have very similar strengths and weaknesses. It's tough. Did you guys feel the right person went home ultimately? Josh, I feel like you have some strong thoughts on this subject.
Well, I mean, I get why Karen went home. I understand it. I think you could have made an argument for any one of those three. As much as it breaks my heart to say it, it was not a great night for Marjorie. So, like, I could have seen Marjorie going. I would have been furious. I would have thrown my phone into my TV screen, and then I would have been very regretful of that because my TV and or phone would be broken. But I would have been upset. I would have been upset, but I would have gotten it. I get it for Karen. I love Karen. I'm sad to see the pink dragon go. But I really felt like it should have been Jeremy's turn. I felt like Jeremy has just... Yeah. I know we don't try and, you know, we try not to take past performances into account too much, but I feel like Jeremy has just been coasting. And we've talked about that a bit here already, that, you know, he needs to do something innovative and step out of his comfort zone a little bit if he wants to play to win. And this was just, I felt, as much as Karen, you know, kind of screwed up the challenge in terms of she was basically cooking Chinese food when she was supposed to be cooking Japanese food, I feel like that Jeremy sort of equally whiffed in the theme. Like, he came up with something that you would find on the menu in like a fine dining restaurant in Miami, you would think. So I thought there was nothing special to what he did. Everybody wanted more Dungeness crab. They wanted more crab in there. They wanted it to be more of a stew that you would get back in that time. So I thought that his dish was really so meh, and maybe not as much of a whiff as Karen's was in terms of Karen just really went off the rails of the challenge. But her food was, in my opinion, probably better and more interesting than what Jeremy turned out with. And I don't know. I just feel like Jeremy is that Top Chef contestant that you just see winning or getting really close to it all too often, and for not really any real discernible reason. So I don't know. I'm done with Jeremy. I'm done with Spicy J-Rock. I would have loved to have seen Spicy J-Rock go here. He survives. Karen's out. It's a bummer. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that overall, comparing the two dishes, I feel like Karen did better in both, harkening back to the theme, even though it was overly complicated. She was able to actually use some part of history, as, you know, as stretched out as it may be, to say, oh, there were Chinese influences. Whereas Jeremy said, oh yeah, they cook soup, I'm going to make my own soup. You know, so I feel like between Karen trying to at least attempt something closer to the theme and her making, I would assume, better food on the whole. I mean, I know Gail said there were notes of really good things in there. I was also surprised that Jeremy didn't go home here, because not only did he not cook great food, I don't think anyone actually made any good comments on the dish in terms of quality. He just didn't do the theme. And I feel like, especially when you're getting down to brass tacks here in the top seven of Top Chef, you need to, you know, you're competing against people that are going to cook great food and they're harkening back to the theme. Jeremy did neither. And so I feel like he failed on both counts and should have gone home because of that. And I'm just really unsure as to why Karen went home above him. Again, we're not the ones tasting it, so for all we know, she could have actually made a worse dish overall than Jeremy did. But I feel like it was more egregious to cook middling food and not utilize the historical period whatsoever, rather than cook, you know, complicated but okay food and at least attempt to do the theme of the challenge you've been given.
Yeah, I think it's tough. I agree with you guys completely, first of all. And I think that, you know, Josh, you say we try not to judge on past performance, but I think Jeremy's going to have a hard time bouncing back from this. I think that the bounce back from this is going to be a really important mark in what Jeremy's season of Top Chef is going to look like from here on out. Because I think that while we say the judges, you know, try to have a short memory, I think that it's got to be seen that his neck was saved, that he got a stay of execution. So the question is going to be, what is he going to do with his life after this? And I think that's kind of going to be tracked. I mean, I think that it's impossible to not consider that. And so I see that happening. I see that coming. And I think that, you know, we could see Jeremy bounce back and do really well, or we could see Jeremy go home next week. I think that Marjorie, I feel like the arrow is pointing more up on. I feel like she made some silly decisions, yeah. but this is sort of an outlier for her. Then I think that it's the kind of thing that comes with taking risks, that occasionally you're going to fall on your face a little bit. And I think the judges probably recognize that. I actually think that hers of the three sounded like the most poorly executed. Exactly. I wasn't surprised that she didn't go home, though, because it was kind of as a mark of sticking her neck out a little bit and trying to do some different things. And I think that more than anything, I think the chefs have, or the judges have really liked that about Marjorie throughout the season, that she's been a person to take on a whole lot and to do a whole bunch of different things and doing the things that are seen as risky on this show. And I think that she's probably getting a little bit of credit residually for those decisions, for making a decision this time for sticking her neck out and trying to do too much and maybe not, you know, editing herself a little bit and getting rid of the bread. I think Karen was probably the right choice to go home, even though I prefer Karen to Jeremy at this point in the competition. I'd rather see Karen on my TV screen. I think that Karen just really, she picked last, so that's tough. I mean, that is really tough. She didn't pick last by choice. She didn't pick last because she performed poorly in the quickfire. She actually was in the top three. She picked last because of a random knife draw. And so she was a little bit backed into a corner there, and then she did not respond well to that corner, and that's unfortunate. She would tell you herself and did say to the judges, like, I wish I had one less hour. I wish I wasn't in my own head so much. I wish I hadn't tried to over-Chinese this dish. And she knows that she went home for it. So that's really tough. Amar did win, so great to him. He raises his arms up, says, go, Amar, in a very kind of sweet way.
Amar.
Yeah, Amar.
I don't think he's going to be winning this either. I'm super happy in terms of both my fantasy team and just my general enjoyment of Amar that he did win, and that he does compare this to a little bit of a marathon. And I think him and Carl were treating this competition a little bit like a marathon in terms of, again, they're not really sticking their necks out there, but Amar decided to do that this time. He said, I know this is probably the most pressure of all the cuisines to cook, but I know I can do it. I've trained in French cuisine before, and he delivered on that. And I think now, if we're talking about momentum here, he might be able to ride this out to take a little bit more risks, because now we're at the final six and there's really no place to hide. As you said, Antonio, three are going to be on the top and three are going to be on the bottom from now on. Nobody's going to be right in the middle. And I feel like Amar might take this as an opportunity to say now, okay, let me start taking more risks and really showing the judges what I'm capable of as a chef.
One of the things that's great, and Antonio, you talked about this a little bit earlier in the show, is the field being wide open and there not being, you know, a clear person who could be taking this thing. And I feel like it's been that way for a while. We talked recently about how that used to be like, it was that way for a good reason. Like, everybody was cooking really well. And then recently it was a little bit of a downturn. But if you just look at the stats right now, Carl is the only person in this top six that has not won an elimination challenge. Everybody else has won an elimination challenge. Now that Amar has, Isaac has won one. He won last episode. Jeremy's won two. Kwame's won two. Marjorie's won two. And there's quickfire win stats that I don't have in front of me. But these chef testants have all, for the most part, done really well. And it's hard to see which one of them is going to be the person that stands on top at the end. I mean, frankly, it might be none of them if Jason is able to wiggle his way back in. But it's a pretty open field, and that's exciting. I think it's really cool that we've got all of these different people who have succeeded in this competition, and that leaves it a little more open than past seasons and definitely makes it a more exciting experience to watch.
Yeah, but unfortunately, one of the front runners is eliminated here in Karen, which I feel like we almost jinxed her in that we called her a big front runner leaving Restaurant Wars. It's interesting because she is, you know, she's very grateful on her way out. Everyone applauds her. I think this is one of the big first times this season where everyone, including the judges, gave her a big ovation as she was leaving. And she seemed completely complacent with her elimination until we get to Last Chance Kitchen, in which case I think all the emotions really come flooding once it really hits her that she's officially out.
Yeah, let's get to Last Chance Kitchen, because Last Chance Kitchen can be fun. We've talked about this a lot on this podcast. It It's certainly a lightning rod of criticism. A lot of people don't like that it exists, feel like it takes the power of the elimination away. Josh, I know, yeah, you can clear your throat because I know that you're in that, you're in that number. Like, you're there on that. But a lot of times it's fun because we get kind of an interestingly conceived challenge for these chefs that does play directly into the elimination from the previous episode. But in this particular instance, Mike, I don't know what your thoughts were, but I felt like this particular challenge was especially poor and not really reflective of any kind of thing that we need to see a chef display to win Top Chef.
Yeah, rare miss on Last Chance Kitchen here. I mean, I think we've talked in the two seasons we covered on Top Chef about how, you know, if you like Last Chance Kitchen or not, they've at least improved on their challenge styles. And as you were talking about, Antonio, saying, okay, you were eliminated for this reason, let's incorporate that reason into the challenge. Here it's, okay, Karen, you wanted to cook Chinese, you failed for cooking Japanese, now you get to cook Japanese again. But it's so weird how this challenge doesn't even seem that focused on the cooking. You know, it's almost like a takeoff on the Instagram challenge that they did a couple weeks ago, where basically what they have to do is they have 10 minutes to prepare a dish, and then they have 10 minutes to, quote unquote, put on a show by cooking the dish Teppan style, which, if you guys have not been to that, a Teppan or a Benihana, it's basically, you know, chefs, it's Japanese food, but it's a big show. They do things like throw eggs in their pockets, cut up pieces of shrimp and throw it into people's mouths. They're banging instruments together like they are musical instruments. So it's very presentational.
At least that's how it is in America.
yeah, at least. I went on my honeymoon to St. Lucia and we went to a Japanese steakhouse and they did the exact same thing. So again, American influences, but
St. Lucia, not exactly right. Japan.
Well, I was in Japan recently. I did get to go for vacation in December and early January. And I did teppanyaki there and it was like so solemn. it was like the exact opposite of Benihana, where it's just, you know, a guy being really artful and serious and dedicated and zoned in on what he was doing, and that was the show. It was like seeing it was like the difference between like going and seeing like a really, really incredibly put together drama versus like an Adam Sandler comedy.
So it's the Hateful Eight versus the Revenant.
I think traditionally it's not the Benihana thing, but it's sort of become the Benihana thing, at least in the States and sort of with the Western influence, which isn't a bad thing. Benihana is awesome. But, you know, I think it's been a cultural difference for sure.
Might be my favorite restaurant. I love
Benihana's great.
Why did I think this was called Hibachi, by the way, guys?
It comes by a bunch of different names. Hibachi is the one that I'm used to hearing about, but I guess it's all under the category of Japanese steakhouse. But I never heard the term teppanyaki
before.
I just heard it shortened to Teppan, which was the name of the steakhouse that was right near my college where we went all the time.
The Teppan Sea Bridge? Is that what that was?
That's funny for a couple of people.
Geographical localized.
I like that you have a Teppan Sea Bridge in you, Antonio. That's good.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm a big Ichabod Crane fan, so I know my upstate and mid-state.
Big Sleepy Hollow.
But I would say overall that not only was the concept of this challenge disappointing, but I feel like the performances themselves are pretty disappointing as well. I think we talked last week about how, well, I think of the people left in this competition, if any of them faced off against Jason, they would crush Jason just because they're more talented chefs. But Karen bombed pretty hard this challenge.
Yeah, she biffed it pretty bad. And it's tough because I think she knew that she did. And I think that she, you know, Mike, you talked about her emotion in getting sent home. I think a large part of that was that she felt like she got sent home for what? Like for not putting on enough of a show in frying some asparagus on a table. I mean, like her dish was okay. His dish was okay. Neither of them were really any good. But what was the expectation that they would be great? I mean, they got 20 minutes to 10 minutes to, you know, cook their to set up their mise en place and 10 minutes to prep it. And I think that it's tough. I mean, there wasn't much variance between the dishes. I think both of them kind of did a very similar sort of breakdown with what they were cooking. Karen tried to make an omelet and she quickly realized that wasn't going to happen on the Teppan table. So I don't know. I thought that this was a very frustrating episode of Last Chance Kitchen. I think it's a shame that a chef like Karen got sent home because of it. If you're going to have Last Chance Kitchen, I feel like there should be more of an opportunity for chefs to really prep, you know, chef's food, not hibachi style Teppan food, which I don't want to knock because I do love, but it just, in the time constraints that they had, nothing really kind of developed came across. It was very similar. And it seemed like Jason got credit for what, like a shrimp skin, like a dancing bonito or whatever. Like, I don't know. I wasn't very happy with this. Karen wasn't very happy with it. It was pretty lame. And all the peanut gallery was getting hammered on sake. So that was the only good part.
I liked how Philip got blamed for it.
Yeah, Philip got blamed for drinking all the sake. That was too bad.
Of course, what does Philip say? No, it wasn't me.
It wasn't me. Somebody else did it. Yeah. So this was good. This was good. I don't know. I felt bad for Karen. I really liked her shirt that she had at the end of the episode, where she had a shirt that said "all that and dim sum." That was like a pun on a t-shirt. So that was fun. But I really just ended up feeling bad for Karen. We did get one thing, Mike, in the Last Chance Kitchen. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Jason's performance? Performance rituals that he's engaging in.
So Jason is apparently a newfound drag artist by the name of Sissy Chablis, and we saw some pictures of it, and they are indeed horrifying, as Jason proclaims, but I think they're purposely horrifying. I think there was one shot of him with like lipstick on his teeth, so it's very clear that he's going for the maybe it's more like a parody drag. I don't think we're gonna find Sissy Chablis on RuPaul's Drag Race anytime soon, but yeah, Jason seems like a very quiet, reserved person. He's probably the least likely person I would expect to have a drag persona, but no, I guess he's something that he's really getting into, and there's a chance we might see, you know, Sissy Chablis come out in future challenges.
Yeah, do you have Sissy Chablis as a dark horse to enter the competition again and win Top Chef?
Yeah, that's a good incredible question, because he's won four now. He's getting into CJ territory, but I don't know. Again, and maybe I feel like I'm jinxing it. You know, the more I disparage him, the more he keeps winning. But I know I just still can't see him winning his way back into the competition, especially if we have like Jeremy or so, even someone like Carl go home next week. I feel like unless it's a challenge of put on a drag show while, I don't know, making breakfast, I feel like Jason's going to get eliminated at some point. He has what, like three more challenges to win? I feel like there's too much of a competition still left in the game to let Jason coast
keep
to the
saying
end.
That.
Yeah, that was going to be my
question.
Yeah, I know that was going to be my question, Mike or Josh, for either of you. Do you feel like every chef that's left is got to be the favorite against Jason in Last Chance Kitchen at this point?
I mean, we've said that. It's.
I know, but I feel like at this point it's a risky thing to say.
I agree. I mean, this guy's got momentum, and if he comes back in, he earned it for sure. But it would be, you know, in defiance of all of our expectations. I mean, we've been saying that Jason's going home, and he hasn't gone home. So good for him if he can keep fighting in there. That's great for him. But yeah, I would say with zero confidence, you know, what my prediction on this is. I think that he could absolutely keep the momentum.
Yeah, it's tough because at a certain point you realize that the chef are going to get faced with a challenge that has something to do with one of the reasons they were sent home. And there could be some real blind spots there, some problems that these chefs have in that manifested in why they were sent home, whether it's refining their ingredients or, you know, cooking a specific type of cuisine or whatever it is. They're going to face a challenge that has something to do with a problem that they showed. And Jason didn't show that problem. Jason's just been there sitting, resting on his laurels, letting his finger heal, and just kicking ass in Last Chance Kitchen. So he's not necessarily going to face up with a challenge. He already defeated his demon. You know what I mean? He already slayed the dragon that took him out of the competition. So at this point, everyone else has to face that hurdle, and all Jason's got to do is kick ass, and he's been doing that so far. I don't see any reason to believe that he's not going to continue to do it. And we thought that he was a good chef kind of when he was eliminated from the competition, but he was all over the place and in his own head, not confident, and screwing things up left and right. These dishes have not given him the freedom to screw himself over and to make some kind of ancient recipe that no one wants to eat. They've actually kind of narrowed his focus into a specific thing and ask him to just do a good job with it. And he seems to be doing a very good job of that. So I don't see any reason to believe that that's not going to continue.
And
I guess we'll see.
And it's a little indicative that, I mean, he had said he had never been to Teppanyaki Steakhouse beforehand, and he just sort of gleaned images and things he'd heard about it beforehand and was able to outcook somebody who specializes in Asian food. So that might be a foreboding sign that he might be able to show down any chef that comes his way, even in circumstances where he doesn't exactly know the food he's cooking.
Yeah, and part of the problem for Karen here is that she had this sort of preconceived notion about the teppanyaki. She cooks modern Chinese food, so her cuisine, I think she probably looks down on this sort of thing. And I think she had to kind of deal with that in this competition. And what she did in response to that, she tried to make it something that she shouldn't. She tried to make a freaking omelet. And that's just not what you do with this sort of thing. And I understand her desire to do that, because for her, you have to elevate teppanyaki in order to do it well. But Jason just came out and did it the way that he thought it needed to be done, not elevated, but just in a standard, straightforward style. And what was the criticism? The criticism on Karen's dish, that, you know, the ingredients, the asparagus was too chunky for a fried rice, that the ingredients weren't cut well enough for a fried rice. And she had to make that fried rice because she called an audible at the 11th hour because her egg got fried too quickly in the teppanyaki. So she was her own worst enemy because of her preconceived feelings about this kind of food. And it's the reason that she got sent home from the elimination challenge, and it's the reason she got sent home from Last Chance Kitchen. So as I'm saying, I really feel like Jason not having those kind of demons or monkeys on his back that he's bringing into each episode of Last Chance Kitchen does really bode well for him. So we'll see about that. Feel free to let us know your thoughts about what you think about Jason's chances to enter this competition. We also have the fan favorite vote at bravotv.com. Should we endorse an official chef for this podcast, guys?
I don't think we need to. I feel like Isaac has this on lock. So
what about Marjorie? What about Marjorie?
Maybe. Marjorie's, when they did the sort of like, here's the updated poll in the middle of the episode, Marjorie was at number 4 below Isaac, Karen, and Kwame. But just to describe this for people that didn't realize it, because it's another like Voltaggio Brothers-esque interstitial between during the commercials. Basically, in the past, they've done this sort of $10,000 fan favorite vote, a la the Sprint Player of the Season, rest in peace. This time, they're doing it by sort of a round-by-round elimination basis. So the fan favorite vote is going to occur every week from now on. But for example, we were voting for all 17 contestants now. Next week, the top 8 move on, then the top 4 move on, then the top 2. And this is running completely corollary to anything going on in the competition itself, or just voting for our favorites every week. But I don't know. I just have this hunch that Isaac's going to run away with it either way.
Josh, any thoughts on this vote?
Philip.
We should endorse Philip. We should push all our votes to Philip.
Philip surprisingly was not last in this. He was actually pretty in the
just
middle.
Just think about what could happen if Philip wins this thing. Just like think about the reality that we'll live in if Philip walks away from Top Chef season 13.
Thinking
as the
about
fan
it,
favorite.
Don't like it.
You might actually make that 2 restaurants album then.
Yes, don't like that album. Yeah. Don't like that reality.
And you don't want that? You don't want
that? Don't like that reality.
No, I will be voting day and night for Marjorie, of course.
And I'm you know, my votes will be for Garrett, but then also for Isaac and for Marjorie. But, you know, this is the thing. Top Chef has awarded this kind of fan favorite award without as much fanfare in previous seasons. So it is fun to see them kind of branching out and creating this sort of ongoing contest. And we'll update as the competition goes on. And if you have any thoughts on who we should endorse as our official kind of fan favorite votes, let us know. You can always tweet at us. Again, I am at AC Mazzaro with 2 Z's and 1 R. Josh is at Round Howard. Mike is at A Mike Bloom Type. And since Kurt isn't here, feel free to tweet Kurt at Kurt Clark, just made up stories about what we said about him on this podcast. You know, maybe a get well soon, or something, you know, that makes it
be safe.
Yeah, be safe. Sorry that you got arrested.
Have fun storming the castle.
Yes. Bye bye, boys. Just whatever we want to do for Kurt. If you want to tweet him some thoughts that make it seem like we talked a lot of trash about him on this podcast, feel free to do that. You can also always leave us a comment at Reality Rehap Ups at robhasawebsite.com in the Reality Rehap Ups section. Our show page for this episode will be up. Let us know your thoughts. If you want to tweet at us, anybody have a suggestion for a hashtag for this episode, guys?
I kind of feel like we have to, again, I don't know if we're stealing from Reddit here, intellectual property, but I feel like I'd want to go with Swanya West.
Yeah, that. Well, we gave credit to the source for Reddit there, so we can certainly do that. Josh, you have any different thoughts?
I thought
Chaos as a platter was really good.
Yeah,
Chaos as a platter is really good. So I think Chaos as a platter is good for me. So if you want to tweet at us your thoughts about this episode, use the hashtag Chaos is a platter. Feel free to go to Reddit and give that name some upvotes as well, because I think that was really good. All right, anything else, guys?
No, I'm excited for next week. It seems like, again, there's some returning chefs going on and there's some purposeful sabotage. So it should be very interesting, and it might lead to another front runner going home. But as was talked about before, it seems like with Karen's elimination, things are wide open, and that makes me even more excited for the next four or five episodes to come.
It's almost like these guys just didn't want to make too many episodes without Philip present. Doesn't it seem that way?
A little bit, yeah.
It kind of does feel that way.
We got the Philip. We got the Philip sort of eulogy at the beginning of this episode. We're going to get Philip next episode, and then who knows? They'll find a way to use him again and again and again. So good for Philip Franklin Lee. We'll be seeing more of him next week. We'll see how that goes. We're looking forward to that. We'll be back here at this podcast after next week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Take care, everybody.